This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
I'm Holly Owen and I'm from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and the Adelaide Film Festival, and I'd like to welcome you to today's session, Hashtag Activism. I acknowledge that today we're gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today and we respect their elders past and present. Before we start, I'm going to ask you to turn your phones off. But if you would like to, please feel free to engage with Adelaide Festival of Ideas on Twitter or Instagram using the handle, or following the handle, at ADLFOI, and the hashtag is the same. Our panellists may or may not tweet during the session, but I'm pretty sure they'll be checking the feed afterwards. The other thing that I'm going to have to ask is that you don't record the session, because unauthorised recordings of the session are not allowed today because we're actually being recorded live for Radio Adelaide. Any other housekeeping? No, not at the moment. I'd like to introduce the panellists today. Next to me, I have Jenna Price, co-founder of online feminist activism group Destroy the Joint, a columnist with the Canberra Times and a senior lecturer in journalism and social media at the University of Technology. Next to Jenna is Anne Summers, who's the editor and publisher of the digital magazine Anne Summers Reports and the author of The Misogyny Factor, published earlier this year, which you can purchase from the bookshop upstairs. And then right on the end we have Monica Dux. Monica's a columnist with The Age, a social commentator and author of Things I Didn't Expect When I Was Expecting and co-author of The Great Feminist Denial. She's also regularly on ABC Radio and 3RRR and has published widely, especially in regards to women's issues. One of the really exciting things that Monica has also done is she's one of the founders of the Stella Prize, which is a major new literary prize celebrating women's writing. And you can find them all online. They're everywhere, the three of them. When I was first asked to host this session, I wrote everyone on the panel an email, and I left out a really important word. I said I was... You know, I had the privilege of hosting the session, and what I left out was that it's a terrifying privilege. These are obviously amazing women, and I feel very lucky to be on stage with them. But it also sort of made me think about something that Monica sent me in the days to come, and something that I saw shortly after Anne recently interviewed Julia Gillard, which was one of the most exciting things that's happened on television for a very long time. And that is this idea that sometimes when we're faced with scarily amazing people, we sometimes wonder whether or not we're clever enough or know enough to be able to join the conversation. And I think that seeing the numbers of really young women asking our ex-prime minister questions on national television was extremely exciting. And seeing women who might not normally feel comfortable joining in discussions about feminism, doing that online at Destroy the Joint. So, Monica, one of the things I'd like you to respond to first, and then it's going to be a free-for-all. No, just because you wrote about it. You wrote about it.
The longest bio, but that's okay. Thank you. Thank you.
It's fine. You've written about this before, the idea that sometimes feminism can be scary to join in.
Yeah, I think that's a really big problem with women feeling they can engage with feminist issues. And it was something with the first book I co-wrote. We surveyed hundreds and hundreds of women, asking the very basic questions about, you know, what did they think feminism was? Did they identify as a feminist? And, you know, who was the most famous feminist? And everyone said Germaine Greer, of course. There was also Andrea Dworkin, but I think they meant Andrea Dworkin. And but one of the things that really struck me with that and really stayed with me is that so many women, and like the majority of women, I would have to say, answered that they didn't feel qualified to talk about feminist issues. And they didn't feel qualified as feminists, that they hadn't studied it, that they weren't experts, you know, and therefore they felt they couldn't engage. And I found that very sad, but I can actually see how that happens. I think a lot of issues to do with women, you know, women do disqualify themselves from being able to talk about them. And this is something which I really liked about Destroy the Joint last year when it kind of... Was it last year? This time? When it came into... When it was born...
August 31st, 2012.
There you go. How time flies. Well, when that
well,
came
an important
into
important date in feminist history.
Yeah, no, yes. See, I don't feel qualified enough. You silenced me.
I feel remember it.
That actual that when that came into being, and the fact that there was a lot of, you know, there's often a lot of criticism about, you know, what goes on online and blah de blah. But I think for ordinary women, women who don't feel that they're engaged, who don't feel like they've studied it, or they don't know how to actually articulate issues, to feel that they have a sense of ownership over issues that do have an impact on them is really crucial and very exciting. And that's what I really like about a lot of what goes on online, is it has enabled a lot more people to engage where usually they would have disqualified themselves.
Can I just say something about, you know, the topic of this session is hashtag activism, but I assume we're interpreting that broadly, talking about online activities generally. And if I could just share with you a few things about what happened with the Gillard interviews that I did, because to me this was an absolutely extraordinary demonstration of the new way, of way things are done. I mean, what happened with that event, those events, as you all know, that I interviewed her in Sydney and in Melbourne, the event was sort of organised about a month before we were able to make it public, because she was adamant that if word of it leaked out during the election campaign, it would be cancelled. And had they been cancelled, we would have lost the venues and lost the money, and, you know, would have been in terrible, terrible financial straits. So very, very few people knew. About 10 people knew altogether. And the Opera House didn't know who the guest was. Melbourne Town Hall didn't know who the guest was. They just had to take my word that it was an important guest and that we hoped we would be able to sell the tickets. And they said, well, you can't sell the concert hall in 3 weeks. Anyway... So on the morning of 10th of September, which was, you know, Tuesday after the 7th, which is the election day, at 7 a.m., we were notified the Sydney Opera House, the name of the guest, so they could go ahead and start printing tickets, and we could release our marketing material. And in Melbourne, the venue didn't need to know because we were doing our own ticketing through Eventbrite. So again, another example of using an online facility which we completely controlled. But what happened is at 10 o'clock that morning, we sent an email to about 8,000 people who are basically subscribers to my magazine. Those of you who don't know about it, here, brochures up here. And we put out a press release and we put a message on Facebook. And I didn't even have time to tweet. And it just went from there. It absolutely went from there. And within 4 hours, Melbourne had sold out, 6 hours, Sydney had sold out. So it was all totally online activity. Word of mouth. I mean, the anecdotal stuff that I'm getting back from people. I was in London, but I somehow got a ticket. People in Sydney couldn't get tickets.
I couldn't get a ticket.
It was sort of so interesting. I mean, you had to actually be online at that moment. A lot of people complained to me, oh, no, I was at work. I didn't get home until 6 o'clock. I opened my private email and it was too late. You know, that was my fault. But it just... but to me, it's just been a remarkable... illustration of the way in which you can do things via online media, via social media, via word of mouth. We had no need to advertise. We had no need to have a proper marketing plan. We had no need to do... We had no need to involve the mainstream media whatsoever. And that in itself is particularly gratifying, I think, to many of us, that we can actually reach each other through these channels that are not only incredibly... efficient and efficacious, they're also free.
The thing that I love about this is that we are completely unmediated. Yeah. You know, for instance, Destroy the Joint is a space where the only mediation you get is if you start, you know, promoting violence towards women, then we delete you, naturally. Not that anyone in this room would have tried to do that. But I got an email because I'm a subscriber to Anne Summers Reports. I posted it on the page within about 2 seconds. Within about 2 hours, people started saying, I can't get 3 seats in a row. And you think you got a lot of criticism. Somehow I became responsible for everything you were doing. And someone sent me a private message saying, have you got tickets? And I said, I didn't get tickets because I'm graduating that night, and that's the only reason that could possibly keep me away from Gillard.
I'm the representative of the angry masses on this panel, those who didn't get tickets.
I'm an angry member of the angry mass who doesn't live in the right state as well. She would, so take that.
Think about that, Anne.
Look, people flew from Perth. Busloads of people drove up from, you know, Canberra. I mean, it was incredible. It was absolutely, you know, phenomenal. No one could have predicted this person who was so hated she was driven from office because of her lack of popularity, suddenly to have all these people, like, screaming and yelling with rage because they couldn't get to go and see her. You know, either because they couldn't get tickets, because they lived somewhere else, or, you know, the tickets were sold out, or, you know, whatever the reason was. And it was so interesting. I mean, it's a great mark, really, of, I don't know whether she'd been so kind of battered over the, you know, the 3 years that she kind of lost a bit of her self-confidence. I'm sure she got it back in spades now after what happened. But, you know, I didn't actually have a conversation with her until the day before the Sydney event. It was all done through her advisor. But when I said to him, you know, we'd agreed on dates, and I'd said we'd have a classy venue, we'd have one in Sydney, one in Melbourne, because she wanted that. I'd originally going to just do Sydney, but she wanted to do something in Melbourne. When I informed her that we'd booked the Opera House, the Concert Hall, the Opera House and the Melbourne Town Hall, her rejoinder was, I hope you have a fantastic marketing plan, because she felt lacking in confidence that many people would want to come and see her. So, you know, that in itself was an extraordinary, you know, kind of boost, I think, to her morale. And on the night, for those of you who might have watched it on television, you know, my first question to her was, are you okay? And her response was, all the better for being here, which is kind of nice. Yeah.
Which kind of leads me to my next question. Jenna, when I checked this morning, there were 37,385 likes. And more importantly, for anyone who works in digital marketing, 8,736 people were talking about the page at the time on a Sunday morning.
And actually, that's a quiet day. I mean, we have days where during the election campaign we had... So usually there's a metric called people talking about this page. It's usually maybe 5 or 10%, even for big brands. But our brand, our group, our community, our feminism so highly engages everyone that we have days when it's 50 or 60% of our likers talking about what we do, which means reposting, clicking on the post, sharing the post with friends. So anyone who tells me that feminism doesn't exist, isn't interesting, has lost its mojo... Does feminism have mojo? Fojo. you know, I would say please look at our page because it's a page which has a huge demographic spread. We've got everyone from, you know, 13 to 80-year-olds. We have them speaking mainly English, some Spanish, a little bit of pirate, which is strange. I don't know why they speak pirate. But, yeah, there's a lot of people there, and they're highly engaged.
And I think what's really interesting also, just to stick with you for a second, Jenna, is that there's a group of people who administer the page.
That's right, and seven of us.
And I don't know the identities of all of you, and that's a great and important thing.
So one of the reasons that we don't let every... I'm old and I'm tough and I don't really mind getting trolled all that much because I'm happy to find those people and kill them. But some of the people are younger and frailer, and I go, I'm hoping that when you watch what I'm doing, you toughen up a bit. There are some other... Sally McManus, who's Secretary of the ASU in New South Wales and the ACT, is also one of the admins.
Do you wear balaclavas in the office?
Don't you love office? We've got a cyber office. So there's seven of us who
has
do
offices
the posts
anymore?
Every day. And then there's another 30 who keep our page safe. Thank you. Who keep our page safe. So that means that if there's a troll attack, we delete those trolls. We check identities of everyone coming in. It's pretty much a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week operation.
Because feminism doesn't sleep.
Because feminism can't sleep.
Can I just say one thing? I did a panel this morning and some really lovely woman came up and was talking afterwards about, asked me, you know, about boycotts and blah, blah, blah. And we were chatting and it made me think about something that's probably quite self-evident. But in terms of talking about engaging with feminism, you know, in the hashtag world, in the online world, how one thing it really has delivered, if you have access to the internet,
you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, if there was an issue that you had, you know, say domestic violence, and you start thinking about those issues, or something that's happening internationally that you want to engage with, for example, Bangladesh with the clothes factories, there are a lot of, you know, dangerous areas you can stray into if you don't know what you're talking about. You go online and you can actually get that information. And if you actually spend the time... And so when a lot of women years ago, when I did this survey in 2007, were saying, I don't feel equipped or about to talk about these issues or to engage with them, I actually think today you have so much more opportunity to do that. You can find out, and you can find out good information, you know, to actually be able to engage so much more than a decade ago. And, yeah, it's another wonderful thing.
I mean, that is the great thing, that online you can somehow tweet Anne Summers and she will respond to you. And that is a really, you know, there's this whole generosity.
On a good day.
On a good day.
She never retweets me.
Are you asking questions? We had a session yesterday where a young woman said, what are the three key issues challenging feminism? And I was able to say, you need to buy the Anne Summers book, The Misogyny Report, and it will give you great details about violence against women and increased poverty of women and equal pay and equal opportunity. And that's the thing about being online, is that it's all there. You can talk to people who are authoritative in their areas, and it's not having to rely on what you might imagine yourself.
That brings me to another point, and we've talked so far about access to information, the ability to join conversations that we may not have felt comfortable or had the ability to physically join previously. How does this translate into real action? How does all of this information and conversation actually affect real-world changes? And I know there are some great examples that have come from Destroy the Joint. Would you like to perhaps mention...
So when people start telling me that they don't believe in clicktivism, I want to find them and wrench their necks from their heads. Because the thing
so
that
violent,
I...
Jenna.
I know, I am quite violent.
That's the second violent
statement
she's made in the last 5 years.
She's really giving us a bad name.
Yeah, that's right. So the thing is that when you think about the very first thing that Destroy the Joint did, which was to encourage advertisers of Alan Jones... To look elsewhere so that you can have an ethical place to advertise your wares. So that was very successful. Destroy the Joint cost Macquarie Radio Network $3 million, and they're still recovering.
Yeah, let's clap that.
A few months later... we
Alan's still with us, however.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but who listens to him?
Yeah. It's interesting, his audience... His audience is declining. Actually, I don't ever kill someone in real life, but thank you. So, a few weeks later, we didn't have to do a public campaign when we were pressuring Telstra. So Telstra had always refused to give women who were victims of domestic violence free silent numbers. They said if they waived it for one person, it would be a precedent for other people. Well, good. So it was interesting to me that I could just email the managing director of Telstra directly, because that kind of information is available online. I got an answer to the request to help this destroyer who'd had this problem very quickly, in 20 minutes, either from him or from the person who masquerades as him, who's the executive assistant. When her fee was waived, the destroyer who'd said she'd had this problem with Telstra, she wrote back, being what I consider to be a real destroyer character, saying, it's good, but now can he do it for everyone? And it took 6 weeks of behind-the-scenes negotiating, which was only possible because of the 20,000 people behind us, for them to say, yep, we're going to do it for everyone. Now Telstra provides free silent numbers. And of course, this week...
We're going to clap that too.
But, you know, for me this week, being able to say we were an integral part of getting Woolworths to sign up to the Bangladesh Fire and Safety Accord, which it's not even compulsory. It's a voluntary stakeholder agreement, a multi-stakeholder agreement, where people are going to work together to improve safety for garment workers in Bangladesh. That really felt like that was doing something. So we are not... I mean, we may be clicktivists, but we're doing something good.
I think also... I mean, there's many different levels to this, and... Going back to these women I surveyed years ago, that fear of not being an activist or not, and I think a lot of people don't have time to do things. But, you know, it's a cliche, but knowledge is quite powerful. And even at that level, like I do agree that, you know, doing stuff online, it does need to translate into action. But not all women are necessarily responsible for that action, because they can't be, for lots of different reasons. But actually knowing that in the first place. I mean, that the for instance, you know, with Destroy the Joint, you have so many followers. That says a lot. So, I mean, even that, putting your name to that site is one little step more. You know, it's that drop in the ocean. But I think that makes a difference as well.
I think, you know, just listening to you say that just reminded me of something that I think is quite interesting and remarkable, and that is when we talk about online activism, I mean, we are, I guess, talking mostly about politics because that's what we're all interested in. But there are one of the things that I like so much about the whole online world, it's opened up opportunities and activities and things to do for a lot of people who wouldn't normally or otherwise be able to do it. And the example I'm thinking of has got nothing to do with politics. It's one of the most sort of fabulous stories I've ever heard. And I heard this a couple of years ago when I was at the National Library, which is one of my most favourite places in the world. They have this great project whereby they're digitising newspapers. And they're doing one newspaper per state, and they've almost finished the first round. And it's an incredibly sort of, you know, old technology job. They digitise the page and they put it up online. And then the pages are full of errors because the digital readers are so, you know, hopeless. So there is this army of people out there in Australia, and they're mostly people in rural areas. They're mostly women, and they, you know, they tend to be unemployed or pensioners or retired or, you know, young kids or whatever. We'll jump online and they spend a couple of hours a day correcting them. And it's so fascinating. There's whole articles about it. Like, some people specialise, you know, some people only do Ned Kelly, some people only do murders, you know, some people want to do, you know, Melbourne Social Life. But, you know, there is this kind of whole community of people who don't even know each other, but the National Library is kind of, was so startled when this started happening that they've kind of acknowledged it. And you can read about it, you know, at the National Library. But it's just, to me, another example whereby if you've got a computer or access to one, you can do things you would never have dreamt of, and you're not getting paid for it, and it's not getting, you know, it's not changing the world, but it's actually making it easier for researchers. I mean, I made extensive use of the National Library's digitised newspapers when I was writing my book, The Lost Mother, because I was reading about Melbourne in the 1920s and 30s, and to have access to that stuff and to read the corrected ones as opposed to the way it comes out of the digital reader makes such a difference. So I just think we should really appreciate the extent to which online, you know, liberates us to do so many things.
Thank you. I'm sure that I'm not the only one here who has questions for the panellists. If you do have a question, now is the time to jump towards that microphone there. If you can speak into the microphone, that would be fabulous, because, again, this is being recorded for radio. No movement. Does that mean we can just keep talking? Is everyone fine with that? Okay, great.
Another thing that, you know, I'm kind of jumping all over the shop, but yesterday I was very kind of moved and actually quite frightened, and I received on my Twitter feed a tweet from, I used to be involved with Greenpeace, used to be the chair of their board, international board, and I'm still a great admirer and follower of Greenpeace. I got a tweet from the Greenpeace in Russia. And they, as you know, there's a, you know, Greenpeace activists have been arrested from the Arctic Sunrise, and they're in prison and they're being denied bail and all the rest of it. Things are pretty horrible. What they did, the Greenpeace people in their office in Marmunsk, I think is how you pronounce it, they had actually looked out the window, and there were six men in balaclavas had crept over the fence and were coming towards them. And they photographed that and put it on Twitter, you know, in real time. So you could just see this thing and you're thinking, oh, my God, you know, what is going to happen? And it's not giving them necessary protection, but it's at least, you know, the core purpose of Greenpeace has always been to bear witness. And in the past, you know, they would take a ship out and take photographs of the French, you know, nuclear tests or, you know, the Japanese killing a whale or whatever. But here was an example of using Twitter to actually bear witness to an act of violence that was about to be perpetrated against them. And it was one of the most chilling things I've ever seen. But at least, I mean, it's notifying and activating people all around the world in a second that this is happening. And, you know, you get onto Putin and, you mm. scream about this. I thought that was incredibly powerful. I don't know.
We saw the Gillard misogyny speech go absolutely viral in a matter of days, and it even hit UK, US, Europe. Why did the Australian media, do you think, get it so wrong and refuse to acknowledge what the world was actually saying by this video going viral?
Okay. I think it wasn't so much the Australian media as the Canberra media. I think the Canberra Press Gallery completely got it wrong. I mean, even the women in the Canberra Press Gallery, who are perhaps a little more disposed to be, you know, sympathetic towards it. I know Lenore Taylor, who at that stage was still with the Sydney Morning Herald, she's now with the Guardian, she wrote a piece a few weeks later kind of looking back on all this, saying that your response to the speech, you know, was to a very large extent determined by the extent to how far away you were from Canberra. And I think the Canberra Press Gallery people were first so obsessed with a couple of things. Firstly, you know, their hatred of Gillard. I mean, they just could not get over, for whatever reason, they hated her, and I don't know why. They used to love her when she was Deputy Prime Minister, but the second she became Prime Minister, they turned on her. Anyway, and I've discussed this with her. She doesn't understand it either. She just, you know, it was just kind of horrible just to watch it. So that the way they treated her and would not give her a go was part of it. The other thing was this, you know, this ridiculous thing saying that she had refused to attack Peter Slipper for his texts about female genitalia and blah, blah, blah. And, in fact, if you listen to her speech, and I've listened to it at least 20 times, she attacks Peter Slipper several times for those texts. So, you know, that is a complete misreading or willful mishearing of her speech. So I think they were just incapable of actually getting the point as to what was happening that day.
They were kind of up their own arses a bit, weren't they? Because it's funny, I mean, I saw that speech. I was about to go on radio for an interview and it was just coming over. And I remember that night sitting down and playing it again. And even those first few words that she spoke, like, it's funny it hasn't been put to music yet. But, you know, if I compare it to, I remember when I was young, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, that when you hear that kind of, the way that she spoke it really, and yeah, I think someone was looking up their own bottom, because it was such a goosebump moment. Regardless of what you thought of what Gillard was doing in the government, anything, it really just rose above all of that. And yeah, I would have to say it's one of the most inspiring things I have seen in the last few years, that, you know, I showed it to my children who are too young to understand it, but, you know, I know when they're old enough, it just grabs something beyond what we were.
And I would say to you all, if you get a chance, go home and Google the press conference that Gillard gave a few weeks before the speech, where she talks about nut jobs and misogynists on the internet. Yeah. It is absolutely inspiring, and people don't remember it now because the thing that came after it was so, you know, encapsulated what we all felt. It was that she was speaking on behalf of all of us in that one instant. And it was interesting. I think one of the things that happened is that we had this moment in 2007 of being so in love with Kevin. And I don't actually think the Labor Party...
Sorry? Speak for yourself.
I was never in love with him.
Okay, but can I just remind you, total landslide, Kevin 07, we were all, hello, it's Kevin, I'm here to help. Everyone loved him. And I think the Labor Party did a very bad job of telling us why it had fallen out of love with Kevin Rudd. And although I got very cranky with Nicola Roxon the other night, when she was, you know, going on and on about this instead of looking at expenses and rorts, I thought to myself, that is true. The Labor Party did not explain why it had fallen out of love. So it was almost as if they were saying to us, oh, yes, Gillard took this improperly. They didn't give us the proper process. It was David Marr's essay in, was it the Quarterly? And there was not really much other explanation. And then there was the changeover. So I think giving it the imprimatur of the entire party would have been better at the time.
Yes. Can you give me your comments on offensive language, especially on Twitter? We often find that, maybe it's trolls, using really offensive language about anyone, even people, you know, you might normally disagree with. We usually just retweet back and just say something like, we find that offensive, and then unfollow them. But, yeah, what's your reaction when you get really offensive language, on Twitter?
I get offended, and when people are really... I mean, I often tell the story of the time that I tracked down a troll and I rang him at his work and I said, I don't want you to speak to me like that on the internet ever again. And it so frightened him that he's just
kept off Twitter ever since.
Did you threaten to kill him, Jenna?
No. Because everyone here understands that's a joke and trolls don't have a sense of humour when they're called out. That is the big problem with them.
Yeah.
Next question, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to say thank you to all three of you for everything that you have done and everything that you do to advance women's rights. I want to frame this really carefully because I don't want this to come across as criticism, but I work for an organisation that commissions independent research every year with young women, and we asked Destroy the Joint to promote it for us. And you agreed. And I'm not sure who was the administrator that day, but they opened the comment by saying, wouldn't it be nice if this was for all women? And kind of set the tone around questioning, you know, whether it's okay that this survey was just for young women. And there were some really challenging comments that came from that. Some nights I had to sleep on it before I responded, but I turned it into a really positive experience to educate a whole range of people about the organisation that I work for, and so that was a really good thing. So I guess I'm... Monica, your research has shown some of the challenges that young women come up against when we talk about feminism. So I guess I've got a few different questions. Does Destroy the Joint have a particular view of young women and their participation in this kind of activism? How can we use online activism to engage young women with what we would maybe like them to engage with? And do we need young women to embrace feminism, or is there another way that we can sort of increase their understanding of the challenges that they're going to face in their life that a lot of them don't realise that they're going to come up against?
Can I just, before we get to Destroy the Joint, I was just going to say, in terms of young women, I've thought this a lot over the years about, and I know myself, I mean, I found feminism when I went to uni and all of that, but I'm also very aware, I think a lot of women who are articulate about feminism or engage with feminism from a young age are usually quite privileged to have the opportunity to do that. I really believe that feminism is something that, feminist issues are things that come to you at certain points in your life, and often, you know, when you're a 20-year-old woman, young woman, the world can seem like a very different place to what it will be like in 10, 20 years. And it was interesting. So we did a panel yesterday, Anne and I and Jenna, and there was a very smart young woman on that panel. We were talking about mentors, and I had to really bite my tongue thinking, now that I'm 40, I don't want to start sounding like the grumpy, you know, woman who starts saying, wait till you get to 40 and people stop looking at you and you're no longer young and fresh and all of this. But I do think that there's this thing of, it's a generational thing, and I think there's a lot of pressure placed on young women, and it's a way that, like, feminism is beaten up because a lot of young women don't want to call themselves feminists or associate with feminists or engage with feminist issues. And I really do think they don't have to all the time, you know. They don't have to. Like, I do think things happen in your life where your consciousness is kind of raised. And when you're young, you're dealing with so much other stuff. The burden to be that certain kind of feminist is a bit much to ask. Yeah.
So I'm fairly confident it was me that day saying, wouldn't it be great if it was for everyone? And that's partly because every day Destroy the Joint is attacked for one reason or another. You know, we're not including this kind of person or that kind of person. We try to be as inclusive as possible. And so the kind of line, which is a way of trying to engage everyone around an area which is just trying to target one group, is really just our way of saying, you know, have a kind of respectful conversation. You know, we have as many women between 18 and 30 participating in Destroy the Joint, or people, actually, because I don't know whether they're all women and men. We've got, I think, 35, 65, as we have women in the target feminist age group. So we have a lot of young female participants. And yesterday at Cherchez la Femme, it was a lot of young women in the audience. So I think they're engaged. I think it's okay not to have to think that something is feminist. I think it's okay to accept that we act because we want equal rights, and we may not call it feminism. I prefer to call it feminism. I'd like to be able to put everyone in that little group, but if people are acting with great values and understanding what social justice is, I think that's good enough. I don't have to have everyone labelled with the same little label.
Thank you.
So I've been to a few activist strategy workshops lately, and Destroy the Joint is often a case study in those, so congratulations. But it's often got a very target-focused, aggressive sort of strategy for pressuring stakeholders, like with the Alan Jones sort of thing. And one workshop paired it with a case study where a gay rights group in the US pressured the Boy Scouts of America to allow gay scout leaders for troops, or gay and lesbian. And they had, as one aspect of the campaign, it was sort of a two-pronged attack. One of it was a very Destroy the Joint style sort of thing, where they pressured sponsors to drop their support the same way that you did with Alan Jones. But the other part was a sort of hearts and minds campaign to try and get, the people of the US on side and to support the change. I'm wondering if you think that there's a need for that sort of hearts and minds thing to complement Destroy the Joint in its current sort of tactics, perhaps to get rid of that pernicious straw feminist stereotype that was mentioned earlier.
Me, yeah.
Your turn.
My turn.
You got the conch.
I wasn't even listening properly because I thought it was Destroy the Joint question.
Do we have to...
Look, I think, when it comes to online activism, whether it be, via Destroy the Joint or via, anybody's Facebook page or, anyone's campaign that they've launched through Facebook or Twitter or email or whatever, I think that we, there are a whole lot of issues out there, a whole lot of problems that need to be solved. And, we choose the ones that we want to address, and some of us choose X rather than Y, and some of us, have a big sort of picture view of things. Other people have a particular issue. And the thing about the online environment is there's room for everybody, and there's room for all kinds of activities, and you can be engaged in about 20 different things at once, and, more engaged in some than in others. And I think that, there are different levels of campaigning and different types of campaigning, and, they've all got their place. So I think we're still kind of figuring out how to make this work politically. It was interesting to watch the efforts of the major political parties in the last federal election. I thought, by and large, they were both pathetic. They had learnt so little from the American experience. I mean, the Americans... I signed up to both the Republicans and the Democrats for the last two presidential elections just to sort of get the material and see what they're doing. And, if I can do it, surely the people who run the political parties here can do it. And I'm not saying we should, slavishly ape what the Americans are doing, but there nevertheless were some important lessons there about engagement that I think we could learn from. And I think that... many of us who are kind of just, as I'm doing with my magazine, just kind of bypassing all the traditional institutions and the traditional ways of doing things because online provides us with the ability to do things that once were only open to people with money or people with, organisations behind them or people with, all the kinds of resources that you don't need anymore in order to get active. So, we can launch our own campaigns. And, I think that we should be doing that.
I think also that, respect and respectful communication, which I think, a lot of people who campaign online and that are very aware of, makes a big difference. In terms of, if you're talking about, capturing the audience and hearts and minds and that, I think there was a piece in the Destroy the Joint book, which I only got to last week, and I thought that nails it, which was Stella Young. And she's a disability rights activist in Melbourne, and she's very articulate. Her tone is... I just think it's extremely smart because she talks about being invisible and talks about not having access to the world in the same way, and she engages with Destroy the Joint. And when I read that piece, I thought, yes, you're rightfully angry about a lot of issues. You've nailed the communication of it because I feel I am now part of that conversation and that's going to make me think. And I think with a lot of issues, not just feminism, but you need to be... If you are speaking and if you are writing and talking, you need to be aware that do you really want to engage with your audience or do you just want to talk at them? And if you want to grab someone's hearts and minds, I think, the audience needs to be respectful enough to be listening and open enough to it, but you also have to be mindful that this audience deserves that kind of engagement. And the online world... one of the good things is it provides, and one of the bad things is it can be very easy to fall into kind of going, you know, fuck you, you know, which we feel like sometimes, but, you know, bite your tongue and try and communicate.
It's always very amusing, though, if you follow Rupert Murdoch on Twitter, as I'm assuming we all do, to see that, you know, whenever he tweets a lot, and he says some pretty loony things. It's great to see all the responses, the way people comment, and it just, you know, they don't kind of abuse him. They just say, you know, they just kind of give it back to him, and it's I don't know. He probably doesn't read them. It doesn't matter. We can read them, and it's fantastically cathartic, at least.
Yeah.
The thing I would like to say, though, is that sometimes it is perfectly okay to be angry, because there is a lot to be angry about. Mm-hmm. I think that there are times to be angry and to organise in that kind of way. There are times to be loving and companionable, but the key thing is to organise. And whatever strategy you're going to use, whatever target you've got, whatever goal you have, you have to have a very clear strategy. And you can't imagine that anger or love is ever going to be enough. You have to have a policy and a strategy that it's going to make it work and have an end target. And whatever it takes, that's what you have to do.
And a clear goal. Very clear goal.
Yep.
Hi. Just actually, this fits in perfectly with what you're saying there about a strategy and a goal. Can you tell me if there's any real push to get education into high schools, particularly about misogyny and women's issues and so forth? Now, I'll give you an example. I live in country South Australia, and I was at my local library the other day, and I looked up all the books that I could think of that, you know, relate to this issue, and I can sadly say that none of them had been borrowed for whenever. I actually gave my library a copy of Mary Crook's monograph on A Switch in Time. I'm proposing to buy Destroy the Joint and equally give that to our library. But I'm just wondering if you know of any real push to actually get, you know, is it just if girls choose, and I say girls, choose women's studies in high school, or is there some sort of concerted push to look at this whole area in high schools? Because I have a feeling that that doesn't happen, and I think we need to be engaging both young men and women in this kind of education and knowledge. Thank you.
I know nothing about the high school syllabus. What about you two?
I think the spectre of Tony Abbott is going to complicate that quite profoundly, but the little that I do know is from the Stella Prize, which I helped found, and we did, there was a bit of, I know this wasn't my department, but we were looking at schools and just looking at what texts get studied in, you know, in high school, and the disproportionate amount of, you know, texts by men in the male canon, and how few women were on that. One thing for that I would say, I suppose sometimes what's very useful if you, you know, don't feel empowered by that, is a name and shame thing. Like you said, you know, and I found if you actually go to, you know, the schools and say, why are they just studying all men, you know, particularly with a girls' school, why is it, you know, the HSC or whatever it is in South Australia, why is it all men on the kind of English canon? I think those things are important. But other than that, that's as far as I would go on the curriculum.
And I think we don't need to worry so much about what's in high school. The thing to do is to occupy the space where all the young people are, and that is not in schools. They don't want to be in schools. They're only there for 30 hours a week. I wonder how many of them are actually really there for 30 hours a week.
Well, maybe drop pamphlets like, you know, that in the wall fly over.
Like Muriel
drop
Matters.
The propaganda. Yeah, so the school children could have access.
Who's
to
got
the
a plane?
I reckon get people like Flume to say, I think this is important, or, you know, get any musician or to talk about domestic violence and to talk about poverty and to talk about racism. I think
there is
the
quite a call for it. I mean, I've noticed this when I've been going around in Australia talking to a lot of groups in the last few months, and it's this question comes up almost every time. People really do think that it should be taught in schools in the way that in a lot of schools talk about racism, and that, you know, we should be learning about sexism and misogyny and the role that it plays in Australian culture. And I think it would be fantastic if we could do that. But the chances of it happening, given the, you know, political makeup of most state governments, is probably unlikely. So I agree that we should be trying to get that message out and trying to educate kids in other ways, and going to where they are is probably the best way of doing it.
Next question.
Hi. It seems like we're talking about Twitter as a kind of a new technology
for engaging in for conversation.
2007.
But yeah, it's
not new.
And in some ways, it's Twitter has perhaps kind of exceeded its limitations in terms of you have 11,000 followers and responding to one tweet. And it's a very kind of real-time thing. How do you respond to a billion responses to a single tweet, or how do you use Twitter as a kind of a real engagement?
Well, I guess anything's a real engagement. I wouldn't say we've got peak tweet yet. We've got peak Facebook.
Yeah.
We've got 91% saturation in Australia. 91% of people between 13 and 70 apparently have Facebook pages, I was reading the other day in Australia. But we don't have peak tweet because we've got, I think, around 2 million users of Twitter in Australia. So we're going to get more. You don't need to respond to everyone, do you? Do you think? No.
No.
You respond to some people who you think the conversation's going to be part of.
Rarely respond. I mean, I see Twitter at the moment. I think kind of Twitter might have peaked, really, in some ways.
Oh, really?
Mm. I'm not sure, but I find I'm using it a bit less than I used to. But I use
Jenna's
it.
Not.
I use it mainly as like a kind of my private news stream. You know, it's the way I find things out now. I mean, I follow I follow people, institutions, publications, organisations, and what have you that I'm interested in, and whose stories and information is what I respond to. So, this is my main news source these days. And so, I pick up the phone as soon as I wake up in the morning, and I've, read most of the papers or what I'm interested in the papers before I get up on my phone. And that's a very different experience from, even to a 15, I think I cancelled my papers about a year ago. But, you don't even have to walk downstairs and open the front door and get the papers in. You can read them while you're still in bed. And in addition to that, it's not just the papers. I mean, you're also getting reports from organisations that you think are interesting, stories that are interesting. You're getting personal stuff from a few people. But I use it. I don't use it so much for personal. It's much more a way of learning, sharing information. It's a great way when you've written an article, like we all do that. You put it up, and it's a way of sharing it with other people. So I sort of regard it as like a personal Reuters service.
Yeah,
really.
I think that's like what we were talking about at the beginning of this panel. That's the most powerful thing and the best thing Twitter can do is give you access to news in the world if you choose the correct followers. There was an example yesterday with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre commenting on six-week-old babies having been sent to Nauru, and put it up on Twitter. It's a confidential source, but then it becomes public, and a discussion takes place around that, and it encourages people to particularly now that we've got all this shutdown from Morrison. So, I think in that way too, in terms of personal activism, actually just having access to that information.
The other thing, so I meant to mention this that I did one of the many interesting things that I learned in the course of doing the interviews with Gillard. I developed partnerships with Google and with Twitter and various other people. Everyone wanted to be involved in these events once they saw how successful they were going to be. So we had a partnership with Twitter, and so I met with the guy who runs Twitter, and he promoted the events. It was too late to sell tickets. We weren't interested in selling tickets. We were just interested in drawing a Twitter traffic to the events. We created four hashtags. One was Julia Talks. And now I got her permission. I said, do you want Gillard or do you want Julia? She wanted Julia. So, okay. I've been very critical in the past of people, diminishing her by calling her Julia, but now I think it's more a term of affection and almost a branding. It's not talking. So we had Julia Talks, we had Julia Sid, Julia Melb, and then we had Ask Julia. So people who watch the ABC broadcast and could send questions to Ask Julia, and they were curated by Twitter and given to me, and I asked some of those questions in Melbourne the next day from Twitter people. But in the course of working with Twitter, what I learnt was, and if I think the figure's correct, of the 2 million Australians who are involved with Twitter, 90% do not engage. They just look.
Yeah.
So it's not an interactive forum or in the way that perhaps Facebook is. People are much more interactive in Facebook, I think. So people are passive recipients of Twitter, and they use it as a news source, information source. And for that, it's fantastic. But if you want to take it a step further and actually get involved, news hashtags and do stuff, you can do that too.
I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is that people talk about Twitter not being interactive, but how interactive was the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age? Not very interactive.
Or The Advertiser.
Sorry. I'm so Eastern Seaboard.
Hi. Firstly, I just wanted to say about the education thing. I was offered women's studies in year 11 and 12 at my school, and it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, and it's led me to pursue a career in around women's issues and around feminism and also personally engage with it. So I think that, you know, there is a place for women's studies and gender studies and feminism in education. But my question is about the Destroy the Joint campaign or movement, I guess. You talked about having a strategy and having a goal and a clear vision. At what point did you have, I mean, from what I know about it, and I've read the book as well, that there was, it sort of started quite organically and had a lot of momentum with the Alan Jones issue. Did you have a clear strategy to start with, or was there a point where you thought this is...
On the very first day we said we want to get rid of sexism and misogyny to women in public life. Now we say we want to get rid of sexism and misogyny in general in Australia, and who knows what's going to happen, perhaps the world.
So nothing if not ambitious. Goals?
That's right, I am ambitious. Sorry.
Do you have any particular other strategies or goals that you are thinking of for the
future?
Well,
we do small campaigns, which we hope feed into bigger results. And I mean, I'm very conscious of the fact that people say we don't do enough about this and we don't do enough about that, but we try and, you know, we have hundreds, sometimes thousands of interactions every day. We don't have a research assistant, although, you know, we're now taking donations so we can have a research assistant. That lovely little button up the top which says donate, destroy the joint on Facebook, please go there. Little ad, facebook.com/destroythejoint. So I would say that we run a lot of little campaigns and we hope that they feed into something bigger. I think there's been a real uptake of interest in issues around feminism and sexism, and I can actually clearly point that out when I look at the numbers of times mainstream newspapers use the word sexism and misogyny in the 6 weeks before, same period of time in 2011 as in 2012. So in 2011, before the misogyny speech, before Destroy the Joint, mainstream newspapers, which we judge through a database called Factiva, had something like 150 to 180 mentions, and a year later it was 1,500. And it's continuing to increase. So I think that's impact. I think consciousness raising, education, targeted campaigns, I think that's going to help. What do you two think?
I think mainstreaming, like, yeah. It's... And yeah, I think that's essential. And that is something that I think has happened a lot since Gillard's misogyny speech last year, is that, yeah, it's much more acceptable to talk about those issues. And, you know, once again, there's often the criticism, but what does it do? And I think it does a lot, because if that's in the news, a mainstream newspaper, and it's talked about as if it's something that we can talk about. I mean, so many women's issues have been marginalised for so many years, and you know, to move away from that and to mainstream it is only a wonderful thing. And let's just hope it keeps going, though.
I mean, my book, The Misogyny Factor, which was published in May this year, the publisher...
New South. Available upstairs.
I will sign. The publisher of that book, when we sort of talked about titles in around February this year, and I had proposed the misogyny effect or the misogyny factor as two possible titles, and we settled on the misogyny factor. But she said to me that even 6 months earlier, it would have been inconceivable to put that word on the cover of a book. So, I mean, that is an indication of the extent to which the word is back in the language, back in everyday speech. We're willing to engage it. We're not... Now, we might be a bit, what's it mean? But we're willing to find, to look at it and find out and have a discussion about it. And that is a profound change, and Gillard did that. No doubt about it.
Yeah, let's clap that.
Can I also just say it's not possible to make change by yourself? Acting collectively, signing up to something that's even in your background, in your backyard, a small grassroots organisation, or a group like ours, Destroy the Joint. I really recommend being part of a group, a sisterhood, a brotherhood, a connected group. That's the only way you can make change. You can't do it by yourself.
Thank you. Perfect note to end on. Thank you all very much for speaking with us today. Thank you all very much for coming. I would like to take up the brilliant idea that the woman who came to the microphone earlier suggested, and that is that, you know, if you can afford to, go upstairs and buy one of these great books and read about it. If you can't afford to, go to your public library and read it. And if you can afford two copies, give it as a gift, whether that's to a library or a person. But this is a really quick and easy way that you can definitely progress education around feminism and women's issues. There are still a few hours left of this amazing festival. So if you feel like it, race out the door and into the next session. The Adelaide Festival Ideas officially does end this evening, but the ideas don't stop between festivals. So if you haven't already, please sign up to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas e-news on the website. Check out Destroy the Joint. If you haven't already, make a donation if donating is part of your activist activity. Come and see Anne Summers and get your very own promotion for the Anne Summers Report.
It's free. It's free.
It's free. And when's the next issue out?
The 29th of November.
Fantastic.
And I've got a CD being released next
And does it have...
I'm now going to break into song.
Please. Yeah.
Don't be too polite, girls. Don't be too polite.
Thank you so much.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.